Hi, I'm Sergey Kuznetsov, and welcome to Chicago Crystal.
Welcome, Sergey, to Chicago Crystal. It is great to have you here. I've been seeing some of your contributions both on the forums and on the compiler, and I'm just super glad to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well, and thank you for the invitation. I love to talk to the people and just share the information, so I hope it will be a great conversation.
Yeah. Just to kind of kick us off, I've seen some comments you've posted about when you started programming, but how did you get into programming, and what got you interested in it?
Oh, so that's quite interesting. So like back in Soviet Union, that was like when I was age 10, I just moved like from Russia to Kazakhstan because like my mom like married to my stepfather, and so when I moved there, like at school library, it was not a huge library. I read all the books that they had, and the last book was like tutorial for the Fortran.
Really? So you started with Fortran?
Yes, and I learned it without any computer. Man. I learned without any computer, but later on, like, I enjoyed it, actually, because you see, like, I love puzzles, and I still do, and, like, any technical challenge for me is a puzzle, so that's why I really love technical challenges. So I read that book, like, I understand the principles, and later on, while I was still, like, 10 years old, like, I had an aunt, like, from, like, you know, direct relative from like my stepfather, who was a computer engineer at Academy of Science in you know, back in Almaty. That's where I used to live from age 10 until age 26 when I came here. And yeah, so she was computer engineer, and when she visited us one day, she said, like, do you want to see the computers? I said, sure, of course I want to see the computers. It was back in 83, right? And yeah. I just came, you know, like I came to visit her to her lab, and she started to show the computers. Like, wow, that's cool. I know how to program it. This is, are you kidding me? Like 10 years old boy, like, you know, and not many people, like, you know, only a few engineers, like, you know, back in Kazakhstan who can tell that they know the programming, right? But I did the programming. And so, like, they asked, what can you do? I said, like, okay, I can do this example. So I built the example, like, you know, there was a few mistakes. They helped me to fix it. I'd run it, and it was working. So it's like, wow. And then, like, they said, okay, like, you just probably learned somewhere, and like, you know, that example, can you do this one? Like, they gave me some tasks, and they explained what needs to be done. I was able to write the Fortran code, and it was executed. They said, wow, you're like a computer mage. That's how I get my nickname. So, like, I'm the computer mage.
Really?
Yeah, like, I'm computer mage for the last 37 years.
Wow. And this was like 83 that you got your nickname, right?
Yes, that was the 83, yeah.
It's the old, man, that's crazy. That's a really cool handle. I like it.
Yeah, it's good. Like, sometimes I dropped from computer and said, just Mage. And all my friends actually named me like Mage, but in Russian, like Magich. Magich, it's some kind of, like, you know, modification. So it's kind of Mage, but still, like, you know, some kind of Magich, whatever it is. But which means the same, just Mage.
Okay. So you're in the early 80s. You are doing, you're kind of impressing your Fortran skills and stuff like that. And then how did you kind of get from there to here? Like, what did you do next?
So I started to come to that lab, to that lab quite often and help them. So like they gave me the chance to play with the computers, like, you know, with the big ones. So that was IBM 360, IBM 370 clones.
Oh wow!
Also, like, you know, some PDP, PDP 11, and VAX VMS. Okay. Yeah. So then at the same time, around like 84, 85, we had some kind of kids club over there where they also taught the computer programming. And that was Yamaha MSX. I don't know if you heard about it.
No.
Yamaha MSX, it was like in the Japanese computers. It's like personal computers, mostly for the Russia bought them a lot. for the Soviet schools. And it had MSX DOS, which actually the MS DOS built for that Yamaha MSX, which was based on Xilinx Z80.
So did the MSX DOS come first, or did the MS DOS come first?
No, that was MSX DOS, which is like just like, you know, copy of the MS DOS. It was exactly the same, but only for the for the Yamaha.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, I know. And that was back in 84 or 85. And
okay.
I started to learn basic, like, you know, all that stuff. But because, like, you know, the Fortran, and so for me it was quite easy. So, for me it was a little bit lazy, I would say. Like, and I was quite lazy over there. So, mostly, like, you know, I was going there to play on the computers because I see it was like lots of the really good games. And then, like, back in the 1986, that lab where I was going to, they were able to get the first IBM, not PC, but XT.
What's that? I'm there's a lot of different IBMs here, so IBM.
No, okay. But initially it was IBM PC, then it was IBM XT, which was like 186, 8186. And then it was IBM 80, and then it's like, you know, all that stuff, like, you know, 386, 486, and whatever.
Okay.
So before, like, 386, they named it as PC. It was 8086. Then it was XT, which was 8186. Then it was 80, which was 182, 86. And then there was 386, 486, 586 become a Pentium, then Pentium 1, oh, sorry, Pentium 2, Pentium 3, whatever. But yeah, back then, so that was MS-DOS, and I started to learn assembly, C. Later on, it was like C++. Too many languages.
That's classic.
And by the 1993, so at the neighbor's labs, so the guys start to build their UDCP host. They were just send the mail, and like they installed first Linux over there.
Really? Wait, when was this?
That was in 1993.
Really? I thought Linux didn't make it to like 95, 96. I didn't realize.
No, the Linux first version of the Linux was introduced in late 1991.
Oh, really?
And so by the 1993, like, you know, mid-1993, it was version like 0.9.3, if I remember correctly, of the Linux. And it was the 0.9 Slackware distribution. That's what we've used.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. But around that time, I was already looking to do, like, you know, working a lot, and I was studying at university, and so I get my first paycheck at the age 13 as a computer engineer.
What? Wait, age of 13?
Yeah, but that was a summer job, right?
Yeah, must have been.
But I got the money back then, so that was like, if it was 13, so it was back in 1986. And since then, I was like working all the time. So I was studying, and at the same time, I was working. And at some moment, I was making really good money, because at that moment, like, I was still at school, but no one is like knew the computer. So the businessmen who was buying the computers, you know, from China and from other places, they brought the computers. I was installing all the software, all the new software, tested it, and from each installation, I was getting like the amount which was equal to, I would say, like, you know, one cell. So if I'll translate the other, you know, back then rubles to the to the US dollars, it was about, like, you know, maybe maybe $300 US, like, in, you know, per installation. And I was doing like, you know, two or three installation like a day.
Yeah. And you're 13, right? That's a lot of money.
No, at that moment it was like, that was back in around like 86. Sorry, not really 86. 88, 89. So I was at that moment I was like about like 16 maybe, but I was still at the high school and I was making the real good money, but that wasn't that long, but still, like, I was able to make some little fortune.
That's pretty crazy. And you were just doing installations, like, you're just installations. Wow, so you weren't even like writing software, doing all that. That
and
is
I, and
that
I
is
looking cool.
Oh man,
I was at school, just like, you know, at the higher, like, just the grade, like, 12, something. But like, in Russia, we had, like, you know, only 10 years of schooling. That's why we had to cramp too much of the information. So, like, you know, at the grade 8, at the grade 10, we usually studied all that stuff. What even here, like, in North America, you usually studied at the first, like, you know, first years of the university, all that calculus and all that stuff. Yeah, but that was fun. That was really fun.
Yeah. So after university, did you go into like software right away? Did you do something else in between?
I was working before university. I was already like working as a computer engineer.
Really? Okay.
I was going to the university just to get a diploma and maybe some more information. But at some moment, it was funny. Like, you know, there was I taught computer, like, you know, computer programming to the teacher who's supposed to teach computer programming in the university.
Yeah. So a lot of people I know that went through university love Fortran. Like, my professors still talked about Fortran when I was going through university, which was a little bit later. Like, in university, was it all C++ when you were doing computer engineering, or was it,
no,
was it still like
Fortran, a little Fortran. See, because I studied computer engineering, which is not computer programming, but it's like electronics and computer programming. And my term paper, was to build a modem.
Oh, wow. Wait, to build a modem?
Hardware, yes.
Wow.
And to program it, yep.
Man, that's crazy. I was, this is going to sound really funny, but I lived in San Francisco for a little while, and I was out at a networking event. It was like a bar, and there was a Node developer I was talking to, and he was pretty young. I would say he was kind of in that early 20s, like 23, and he was talking about the TV, like the, you know, where there's a TV at the bar, and he was like, I wonder how much information you could pass through, like, sound. Like, you could have, like, a high sound be high, like a one, and like a low sound be zero, and I'm like, have you never heard of a modem? And it just dawned on me that he had never heard he had never heard the sounds, like, he had never heard a baud, like, I mean, he just, he, like, yeah, all, he missed that entire thing, and I was like, it just
completely.
Yeah, he just reverse engineered his way into a modem. I was like, it was a funny moment.
The funny stuff is that back then, I had my like Fido BBS. Like, you know, I had my BBS and my Fido
BBS
node.
Yeah,
and I had my Fido node, and quite often, like, you know, like, because I had like allowed hours when they can call to my BBS, and so quite often they called outside of those hours, and when I hear like, you know, some kind of like, you know, quietness, I said, and the modem start, like, you know, like, and the other side, like, you know, start to, you know, to play, like, you know, the modem not, because they start the time, actually, the modem, and I go, like, you know, I start to yell at them, but exactly, you guys call me not at the loud time, but that was fine.
Did you ever play Trade Wars?
Trade Wars, it sounds familiar, but I don't remember, it was so long ago. What was that?
Okay.
I played Elite. A lot.
So Trade Wars was like a kind of like a, oh man, I don't, I'm gonna explain it and someone's gonna be like, that's not it. It was kind of like Star Trek, and you would trade things and go from different spaceports and sell them. It was a BBS based game.
Oh, the BBS games. No, maybe yeah. Yes, but I played Elite mostly.
Oh, okay.
Which is the same.
Someone spun up a instance of Trade Wars a few years ago as just like a hosted web service, and I played it for a little bit, and it was pretty fun. But I mean, it's so old in its style of gameplay that it's only fun for a little while before a little bit of it gets kind of annoying. But it was super interesting to see a BBS game be reborn.
I played a lot, actually, BBS games back then. It's like, you know, the test, like crawlers, or like, you know, up, down, left, right, and whatever, you know, remember it, right? And at the same time, like, I loved to play the Core Wars. Remember the Core Wars?
No.
Core Wars, it was like a small program where you ran the code that's supposed to survive, and at the same time, or at the time, to kill the opponent's code. And so, like, and they do the same, and that was quite interesting, like, approach. So it's some kind of, like, you know, the programming, like, the war of the programmers, because when they're writing the code, and so you have some kind of amount of the memory, and you have to build this stuff to survive it. So
that's
you can look at it. It's named Core Wars.
Core
Yeah,
Wars,
like Corewars. Yeah.
I kind of like the older style games in some ways where it was just a little bit more focused. Mm-hmm. And like the open world concept games, they just get with, you know, there's, you know, everything from like crafting systems to weapon systems to skill systems and all this stuff. Like kind of the older style games were just, they were interesting in a way that they had like a very narrow kind of like, they were complex and they were hard, but they weren't like, you didn't have to learn all these different systems. Like they were pretty good.
Yeah.
And so how did you get from that and kind of, I mean, what did you do next? Did you ever make it into Java? Did you kind of go from the traditional C++ surprise to Java route?
So, yeah, but because I started with assembly and with the C, I was really hardcore system programmer. Right.
Really?
So like I always, like, you know, like I always fight it for the optimization of the bio, like, you know, all of the machine code to make it, like, you know, like extra, like, you know, CPU cycle.
Yep.
And at some moment when I was building the Bresenham, like line algorithm, like, you know, like, the Bresenham line algorithm, right? So what actually happens, I was optimized like hardly, like, you know, really, really, really hard on this assembly, build it, like, you know, like optimized everything I can do.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
It was about like 80 bytes, something like that. And then I did the same code on the C, optimized the desktop exactly, like, very strong. Like, and then I put like all the maximum optimization. And when I compared the code, it was almost identical. What I've built, compile it done. And so what I said, like, no, okay, now I forget about assembler and I do everything on C.
okay. Wow. That's kind of crazy. And man, that's super fun. I always liked programming assembly in college, but after college, I never did. I love the kind of talking about, or at least do like thinking about the low level systems programming, but I don't do it. I don't do it professionally. I've never done it professionally. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of a little bit envious of that. So you went from assembly to C, and then what was this job that you were doing?
And then
C++.
Yeah, and so back during that time, I was really working on different jobs, doing some drivers, some optimization stuff. Then I did some internet stuff. I always before going to Canada, and maybe before that, I tend to be like system hardcore, like system programmer. So I was working with the Linux kernel back in 1993, like, you know, some cool stuff. Later on, like, when I moved to Canada, I moved to Canada in 2000. So I started to play a little bit more like with the Linux kernel and build some firewall prototype, which I will talk a little bit later about it. It was fun, by the way. I was beating the checkpoint firewall like a crazy. Performance-wise, it was really crazy. but because I couldn't find, like, you know, because my English was not so good, and I didn't know how to find the investors, so I just leave that idea. But then it's what I found, that everything what I was thinking about, it becomes some kind of eBPF stuff. So eBPF, they kind of have the same principles.
Yeah.
eBPF, it's like, you know, it's like Linux kernel, like, you know, some kind of filtering stuff, like, you know, it's bytecode at the Linux kernel level. So it's like,
you know,
Linux kernel level, Linux kernel is executing the bytecode at the kernel level, and it's so freaking amazing.
Yep. Now there was someone that did a lot of performance work, and he was the guy who did like flame graphs. He was, or made them more popular in my like from my understanding, and he just did a book on eBPF, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No,
what's his
eBPF
name?
Is good.
Oh, it's Brendan Gregg. I think it's Brendan Gregg. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes, sounds familiar. Probably I saw his like, you know, his publications. But yeah, so but back then it was like I built my code when they were like heavily optimized, and I will talk about it a little bit later because like I'm just jumping on and off, like, you know, in the history. So.
That's
back
fine.
In so like my Java experience, so I started to work with the Java experience, like it so like I started to work on with the internet around like 1994.
Okay.
When like I started to work for International and Trans Telephone Exchange, and that's the only internet you can get back then.
Well, I mean that's the crazy part, right? I mean 94 to 01, wasn't that the telecommunications internet revolution? Everyone was buying everything, the stocks were going bananas. I mean that's the time to be in there.
But back in Kazakhstan, it was like, you know, completely like, you know, not so much of the revolution. And the only place like But back then, like, you know, I used to work for the International Telephone Exchange for for a few years, and because for us it was free access to the to any part of the planet, because they own all the channels, right? So we were downloading lots of the software. Like, I was learning like a crazy, and reading, and I started to do the. I became the first internet admin in Kazakhstan.
No way! What?
This
is the thing where you can like get IP blocks and stuff like that. Like, this is the first, like, this is the
communication. That's what I was doing. I was like, I was actually helping them to build all that infrastructure, like for the modern tools, all that stuff, like, setting it up, and building the billing systems around it to help them to charge the customers, the modern tools. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
That sounds super fun. Oh man, that's super crazy. Did you run the domain name server for Kazakhstan?
That one was handled by the Russian side, because before it was Soviet Union, right? Before 1991, Republics was disbanded and become independent, and because of that. It was handled by Moscow. I was doing lots of the other stuff, and I did lots of programming over there, and that was fun.
Man, that's just such a different era, and it was like so fun, and I love reading about and learning about some of the networking stuff. I'm actually reading a book right now, No Better Time. It's about Akamai, the first mm-hmm. CDN, and mm-hmm. talking about like the worldwide weight and like all this type of stuff that went on during that era, and like the things that people were trying to figure out, and BGP, and like it was crazy. It was super fun.
They lost it to the Cloudflare because
really?
Akamai was the biggest one for the CDNs, and now it's looking under the, but it's mostly for the CDNs. So now the maybe I'm bullshitting here, because you see the Cloudflare, they do the protection, so they still provide the for the CDNs, they may have, but Akamai also provides that kind of DDoS protection, everything like that, service and going to them. That's why a little bit missing up, but that was really huge. You're gonna be surprised, but all the DDoS attacks for protection, which is done on the Cloudflare, it's done on Linux boxes with eBPF code.
Yeah. I didn't know it was eBPF code. I have spoken to people from Cloudflare. I used to work at Fastly, and we used to talk back and forth with the different engineers. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting to hear what their problems were and what they were doing. They are awesome. They're a massive company. I mean, they've done a lot of really interesting work. And then there's Amazon with CloudFront. I work for Fastly. I think that's super interesting. Mm-hmm. That space is becoming more and more interesting. I mean, it's not the same as, the origin and the dot-com boom and writing the first CDN, but it definitely, the work that people are doing now is super fascinating and super necessary. And I didn't realize they're using eBGP. That is super cool. I wonder if they've done a blog post.
It's not BGP. It's BPF, eBPF. It's
EBTF.
It's Berkeley packet filter.
That's right. EBPF, that's right.
And BGP4 is different. It's like it's routing protocol, which is I know quite well as well.
I don't really know it that well. I've heard a lot of people talk about it, and there's a lot of people have done some really interesting things with it, but I have not.
Border gateway protocol. But so if you know how to read the BGP updates, from the history, you can see how the internet was developing over the time, because all those updates, you can access it from around maybe 1999, but not that much. And if you will replay all of them, you will see how the you will see how the how the networks was added, how the routing was changing, all this stuff. You can even see the attacks. Like, for example, when the hacker was intercept the traffic and send it to their host instead of the legitimate one.
Interesting.
And so all that history is stored. So you can go to the right side or to the other ones and download those archives and just see the core wars in the network, in the internet.
That's super fascinating. So just moving on a little bit. So you were doing this core networking stuff, and you were doing part of the internet. You're just kind of getting the internet up and running and being part of that revolution.
Back in 1994,
how did you get to how did you get to how did you get from there to where you are now? I mean, it sounds like you've done a few moves and maybe possibly changed a few languages, right?
Back in 1995, when I was young, I was learning the new language crazy. So I could write back then I could write on 10, 15 languages, and I could read about 40. Now it's I knew Prolog. I loved it.
Okay.
You did? And did some stuff. Yeah, Prolog. I loved it. I knew Lisp. I hated it, and I still hate. C, C++, basic assembly, different flavors of the assembler. I wrote first Java applet back in 1995, and that was quite a fancy one. Because I always when I'm learning new technology, I always trying to think of some kind of pet project to work on, because this is the only way how I can perfectly learn the technology and what they can do with it. Because if you just read, you will not remember that. So you have to try it on something. That's why I always start some kind of pet projects I'm playing with.
Okay.
And I build some kind of small applet, which is it's some semiconductor skin.
Okay.
Where I have central processor in this, in the center, with your logo and with the name of your company. Then on the side, it was programmable number of the buttons where you can put some kind of labels, what they're supposed to do, and some actions. And it will put it around that central unit, and it will create some, the connectors, and it was kind of tracing in the same way how it's usually done on the in the tracer. So I bought it from the Java applet, and it was quite widely popular between my friends.
Very
and
cool.
So they got it and they put it on their websites all over the place. It was so fun.
So back fancy. In the day where Java applets were all over the internet.
Yeah.
And then
And JavaScript, and I started to do the JavaScript as well. But again, so I learned it, I tried it, but I didn't enjoy it because performance-wise, it was too slow. And because I was always hardcore programmer. So I said, I know this stuff. Let's move on.
I think people don't realize how far JavaScript has come. I mean, originally JavaScript, I don't even think had the keyword this, it was a completely different language at some points, right? It's gone through massive.
No, this was there. Bullshitting, but I not remember. Back in 95, it was there. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Oh, really?
Maybe I'm mistaken, but I think it was there. But again, I don't want to bullshit. I don't really to bullshit. Because it seems, for me, this is natural. So that's why, I don't remember if it wasn't there.
And then, how did you get from 95? So you've gone through Java, Fortran, C, C++, kind of moving forward. How did you, get to the point where you discovered Crystal?
Oh, so then I was working for the banks. I used to work for the French. I used to be EDP manager for the French bank. So that was fun. They hired me. Back then I said that I know COBOL, but I didn't know the COBOL at all. They hired me and they sent me for the training to the Paris. And my manager, he realized that actually I don't know the COBOL. What he did, he gave me that was Microfocus COBOL. He gave me the book about the COBOL, about the Microfocus COBOL. And while I was flying to the full, from Almaty to the Paris, I learned it actually.
I love it when people do that. There's a few people
buy the book. The same how I'm done.
I love it. So there's a few people I've known that have done like the, oh yeah, I know C++, and I'm like, really? And then they get on a plane, they fly somewhere, they take an interview, and they learned it on the way. I actually did COBOL in college, and I really enjoyed it, and I don't know why. Yeah, I can never tell you why I enjoyed COBOL. But like,
remember the Type 77, the Type 88? That was quite fun.
I don't.
It was kind of like, you know, destruct and union. In C, so it was quite fun.
Oh, interesting.
I liked it.
I don't remember. Yeah. I don't remember that specifically, but I just remember really enjoying it. We actually did this one project where we had to take like a COBOL program, output some data on a mainframe, read it, do do like a separate program in assembly, and then pass the output from the assembly program out to a COBOL program, and then generate a report in COBOL. And I could not tell you the exact things I did. I don't even remember the syntax really. I just remember that program was super fun. I loved it. I really enjoyed working on the mainframe. I thought it was like a really fun project to do. And I had a blast with COBOL, and I really enjoyed assembly. Assembly was my favorite, but I don't even remember, like, I remember some like small things about that project, but I don't remember specifically. I just remember loving it. But assembly, like handwritten assembly, is super fun. We would do a few different sorts. We would write the sorts. Like we wrote the GNOME sort, which is an awful sort. You should never use it. But it's just like something that we wrote in assembly.
My
like,
favorite just, is the like, merge sort.
Merge sort is it's a very classic one. I think that one is it's a combination
easiest,
of a few. It's
the easiest one. So like for me, the merge sort is easier than the quick sort.
Yep. Well,
and performance-wise it's about the same, like n log n.
Yep. Well, quicksort, if I'm not mistaken, someone's going to pull out their algorithms book and school me. But quicksort was it has less bad cases, there's less worst cases, right? So quicksort is used because there's less cases where it will have a worse performance, but it has similar performance to a merge sort on the average or normal case. Is that right?
Yeah,
I think that's
from
my
more stable.
Oh man, this was super fun. I remember red black trees doing data structures and doing some algorithms classes.
Yeah. My favorite, not red black trees, but AVL trees. I like AVL more.
Oh really? I don't think I actually covered that in classes. I haven't really gone back. So I don't know that
because
one.
It seems like red black trees are maybe I'm mistaken, but I think because you see AVL, it was like that was like Russian algorithm. Maybe that's why, because they're kind of similar, but the idea is AVL is quite simple. Why? Because like when you build in like, you know, and you put the counts, you just like to see how like, you know, you have the on every count you have. So it means like you always control that your children is not deeper than more than two. So all the stuff. So again, there's some kind of performance improvements over to red blacks trees, but in overall, the red black trees work a little bit better. But by some reason, I always liked the AVL.
Okay,
but they similar again. I remember there was some kind of issues with the black trees recently, and they built some kind of new algorithm. But I didn't remember. I don't remember, so I don't want to bullshit because it's like I stopped to do system programming for some time. But I still like follow it, and I still like do lots of the stuff for that. But again, so I usually have a motto to stop bullshitting and do some good stuff. That's why, like, you know, like if I don't remember exactly what was wrong, like with the algorithms, like I don't want to bullshit again.
Okay. I remember my very first job. So my very first job out of college, it was the interview for that job. And I was actually interviewing with two Russians who had immigrated. Well, one Croatian and one Russian who had immigrated to America. And they let me sweat for an hour trying to do the depth first and breadth first algorithms for a graph. And I think I got it at the end, but they made me work for it.
That's good. So I usually do the same. So when I'm interviewing the people, but I'm doing it differently. So what I do, I usually see how fast they can learn stuff, right? So if they don't know, like I usually ask like, you know, some kind of ever increasing like complexity questions, which actually link it each to other, right? And I'm asking them, and I say, like, you know, so like, what do you know? So what is this one? So how it works? And then if they don't know, I'm just explaining them what's supposed to be done, and then I ask them again and to see. And by the end, when I already explained how the stuff works, I ask them to build the task on previously acquired information.
Okay, interesting.
And it shows perfectly. It just shows how people can file, how fast they can learn. And convert that knowledge to the working world, and it will tell you about the people a lot, because I feel like I've done all that stuff already myself, and I'm the people who is curious enough. But that's how I usually do.
Very fun.
And I love to be interviewed and to be tested. Love to go for the interview just to show myself can I do it? Can I pass it? And
Yeah. Interesting. So kind of moving a little bit closer to Crystal, how did you get from there to finding Crystal
when I was more into the Canada, I was starting to work for UUNET. It's like internet provider. Big one internet provider. And I built my billing systems, huge billing system. By the way, that system was working from 2000 until 2019 or maybe 2018. So for 18 years without any the same old code I built back in 2000. And it was doing quite well. So that was a huge data, a huge database. So they kept about 2 billion records in the database, and it was lots of fun. So and then so that was built on Perl. Then from the Perl, I moved to Ruby around 2005, late 2005. So on Ruby, I found that Ruby on Rails framework, and I said, okay, I want to try it. At that moment, I was working for the ISP Telecom. It's small CLEC provider here in Canada, and they had almost nothing back then. So I said, okay, guys, how about if I will just build your telco provisioning system on the Ruby on Rails? Are you okay with it? And they said, okay, we don't care. As long as it works, go for it. So I use Ruby on Rails, and I built the provisioning system with all the integrations for LNP, local number portability, wireless number portability, all the integrations with all other carriers. So lots of the fun. So that system's still working.
Wow.
So I always
is that system still going?
Yeah. Oh yeah. So back to, from 2006. So now it's still 14 years and still going.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah,
and so
sometimes I still support it, help them with the advice, what needs to be done, maybe a little bit of coding there and there. But now I am moving away from the coding more to the architecture, because I do the architecture for a long time. Yeah, like I was saying, because it's still since 1995 or whatever, maybe even before that. So for 25 years, I do the end programming and architecture. But I enjoy more architecture, because you have to keep away a lot of the information as an architect in your head than when you're just programming. Because you have to keep you have to keep thinking what may happen in 10 years from now, in 15 years from now. That's why all my systems is working for that long. Yeah, so back in the, back then, so again, I'm just jumping. So back then, I started doing Ruby on Rails. I really loved the language. And so I said, it's fast, so I will stick with it. it's slow, but I love syntaxes, so I will stick with it.
And so
I built a system, then I moved to the other company who needed Ruby on Rails developers, but actually it was not Ruby on Rails, but C#. So again, on the interview, I had to learn on the fly C#. I became a C# developer for some time. From the C#, then I started to work for the other company where I rebuilt a financial boutique. It's hedge fund boutique, and I rebuilt their system from the scratch again. It was really slow for them. It was crawling. It was built on Ruby on Rails, by the way. But it was crawling. I tried to improve the performance, but it was maximum what I was able to achieve is 25% improvement, but it was not enough. So I rebuilt the system on the C#.
Interesting.
Yeah, I rebuilt it, and so I did it back in 2010. So now it's 2020, and it's still working. And nice. It's flying the same way like Node. When I rebuild the system, they finally got the speed they wanted. So I'm still working there. And then, around maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I saw the crystal and I thought, okay, this is actually Ruby and with LLVM. So it's so freaking crazy. I really like it. But again, yeah. I played a little bit with it, but I didn't have enough time because I always like, you know, you need to do this one. But I still played with it. Mm-hmm. And so finally, because you see, for me, the biggest issue is because if I didn't have really good debugger, it's really tough to stick with with the language. And so I said, okay. Yep. Last year I said, screw it. I really like the language. I hate Go. I don't like the Go at all. It's a little beyond, but syntax is terrible because I love OOP, right? So like for me, the OOP is a must.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, the crystal is really OOP where everything is there is an object. It's the same like in Ruby. That's why I loved Ruby mm-hmm. as well. Yeah. Where I can say one dot, our dot from dot now, right? And which yep, will yep, be amazing. Yep. And, so I said, I will use it for my project. So I start to work. I hate to put all that stuff, put S, or P. So I said, okay, I will spend some time and I will dig into the code because code is good. So it's built on the crystal. So it's readable. Not perfect, but still, I can understand what's going on. So I spend my time and that's why I started that thread about debugging support on forum. And when I said if I'll start to work on it. So I start to work on it, dive in, so remembering my old system programming experience.
Yeah.
And dive in. So I use too much of the put S in the debugger to be able to get what I wanted. Then, finally, when it starts to work, little bit of that one. So I start to mix, put us with the debugging support. So I debugged debugger with the debugger.
Yeah. That's pretty crazy. So I actually missed building a debugger in college. That was a class that I didn't take, because I took mm-hmm. a different focus, but I know how to use some debuggers, but I'm not a power user of the mm-hmm. debugger. I always feel a little I really enjoy debuggers. I can do a watch, I can do step throughs and I can do different mm-hmm. things. And but if you watch someone who really knows how to use a debugger, really mm-hmm. knows them in and out, they can just get so much information and context out of a program. Yeah. It's amazing. And I don't know. I love the work you did with it. And I use it inside VS Code. And I actually tried the command line one, and it was too slow for me. I couldn't get the things I needed fast enough.
Yeah, the command line is good, so you will use. But the issue with the code LLVM, they somehow screwed it because now it doesn't work. I don't know what's going on, but older versions was working fine, but now it stopped to work, and I am trying to figure out. But yeah, so I tried the native debug, so I don't like it because it doesn't use renderers to show the proper data. So that's why I use I found the code LLVM. I saw that it's using it. So I tried it. So I see it works. That's why I recommend it to everyone. But again, the issue is that when you are running into something the code, which have some kind of deeply embedded, for example, AST code, right? It's stuck. So it's spinning. And to solve that issue, you have to go to the code LLVM and to disable dereferencing for around that time. So you pass that code, go back to the settings, enable dereferencing, and you can go again.
Interesting. So for those who don't know, why don't we describe what a debugger is? I'm pretty sure most people will, but just in case.
So the debugger is the interface which allows you to snoop into your code. So for example, it allows to execute your code, but not at once. But you are able to go and to say, for example, execute the code up to some moment and stop there. And when it stops at that moment, you can analyze. So what do I have in the memory? Why that address? or by the data address. But if you don't know like what address to look at, that's why we have the debugging support where we store the information about, so this actual address is this variable. So the compiler itself stores the information about the physical address and how that correlates to the variables that it that was in the code.
Yeah.
That's what gives the flexibility. So you can just analyze the memory as is, or you can get the value. And if you have the type information, if you have the type information about that object, so you can see and represent it in the way you want.
Yep. A lot of the information gets stripped away in production code. So we actually have to build code differently for debugging, right?
Yes. No, but you still can use it. So you can just, you can still decompile the code like with all the optimizations, all the production, all the release optimization. The code will be there. You still will be able to store the debugging information, but that information may be not correct.
Okay.
So you still can use it, but it will be not correct.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Maybe somewhat correct. Because
all I didn't actually know you could.
Yeah, no, you could. Oh. What happens usually, because when you have the debugging information, it's somewhat localized around one string. But when you do the optimization, so all those blocks can be like rehash it and to put it in the more optimal way. So that's why you may think that you're on this plan, but actually you're not on that plan because all the information is intermixed. That's the only difference. But you still can access, if you know, for example, that this, because you see, if you know that you're in the deadline and you have that variable, you still can access to the value, like in the memory, to the value of that variable and read it. But again, that may be incorrect information. That's why with the release, like when you do this in the release mode, that information still kind of correct, but you cannot rely on it.
That's really cool. I gotta go try that. I'm gonna go after this call. I'm gonna go start messing around with some production code and debugging.
Yeah, you can do the release and then like debug, and you will still see the fast code, but probably your line information will be screwed.
Okay. Another quick question then. I missed the debugger class in college. What are the parts of the debugger, and what do people know about? What do people, I guess, need to know about how it works? Like, I know a little bit about like some components, but like, what makes a debugger different than another debugger, and what are the different parts?
Usually, the debugger themselves they're similar. So what they do, they just allow it to stop at some moment, analyze, and continue. So you can go to the next breakpoint, or when I'm doing like step by step, step by step. In that case, what it does, it just moves. So there is the comment which named I don't know what the most feature is right now. Is it C3 or CC? Not remember. So there's a very short comment like one byte, which is actually that's C3 because int 3. Yeah, that will be C3. I believe it's C3. That code which is in source. So when they go, when the CPU goes to that line to that machine code, and when it executes, it calls interrupt 3. And on that interrupt, usually you have your code which will stop the application, get information, process, do some kind of operations in that in the way you want. And then it can continue. So, for example, you can say remove that breakpoint code from the memory, replace it with the original one, and put that code somewhere else. So it will run, and when it will hit that breakpoint code again, it will stop. And again, you can analyze. You can see what is actually in the memory, what is in the register, and everything like that. So this code is identical for everything. Not for everything, but for any platform. What the difference is, so for example, we have a dwarf protocol, which is the standard for the all Unixes. So like Mac OS, Linux, any kind of Unix flavor, they support it. And that's where they store all the information about how the debug information mappings are stored. So for example, which line from looking, you know, for example, this line get cut from this byte up to this byte, like, you know, from this address up to this address. So for example, like the all the information about the types. So for example, how the types are created, and that's what exactly I was doing, like, you know, through the LLVM, like inserting that information. But at the same time, we have.
Isn't this where your Python code came into? You had a little bit of a Python patch, right?
Oh, that is for the LLVM itself, because the
it instructs
LLVM how to read like that code and how to format and to show it on the screen. That's for the LLVM.
I thought that was a formatter.
I have to do the same Python code for GDB, but because I'm the Mac OS guy, GDB actually doesn't really work on Mac OS. So like for that one, I have to use my Linux, my Linux server. And because my Linux server is quite remote, like, you know, I'm quite lazy.
It's kind of funny.
I didn't have enough time for that one.
I spent about 2 hours trying to get GDB to work on my Mac, and I, you know,
I spent much more time over that.
Put it into I put it into like single user mode and disable all these things and signed it, and did, I couldn't get it to work. I have no idea what's going on.
What at the end you get the zombie process.
Oh really? I don't know if I actually got that.
Because the GDB hangs. You have to kill GDB. And if you look at the memory, you will see the zombie process of your debugged program. But that program is not in the memory; it doesn't take any CPU. It just records in the in the tasks.
Is that? I wonder if that's a Mac thing, or I wonder if that would be the same. I don't. Mac does some weird things with so many things. I can't tell what's a Mac problem, what's like a Unix problem, what's a GDB problem.
But at the same time, LLDB works, and I also build I have my own program I built on Crystal. Which is actually doing some debugging. So I am able to put the breakpoint. I am able to stop at that breakpoint. I am able to read some value from there, modify this memory in the value. So like when I run it, then you can see that that program is showing some kind of modified value. Yeah. It's just like it's a very simple one. So I want to continue to make it for the Mac. For the MacBook for now, because that's Mac OS dependent. But I want to use that code for the debugging one, because see, I hate most of programs like GDB or LLDB. I don't understand that they must be flexible to work on different platforms, but for me, it's way too much, because I'm preaching the KISS principle, right? So, like, you know, and I usually follow the same thing. I usually follow what I preach.
People love that. Yeah, I like it. You mean to keep it simple, right?
Yeah, exactly. Keep it simple. If you want to be a great programmer, you need to know all the tools. Keep it simple, and also defensive programming. So never trust any parameters coming to your function. And validate them and check for the null pointers. If you do that, check for the null pointers for the values within, like, you know, within the code, and you're good.
I remember there was this one Java program I worked on, and there was a null check at the beginning of a really critical path function, and nulls kept on getting in. And for some quirk in the language, like that specific null check like didn't work. And I don't remember what the specific detail was, but holy cow, did we burn a lot of cycles in that problem. And, you know, nulls kept on getting through. We had a certain set of messages, and we could run them in that order, and a null would appear somehow in the middle of this function. It was just like, it was the weirdest thing, but whatever, we got it fixed in the end. But it was definitely like a strange Java thing that I had never known.
Because I'm a system programmer, I'm spending too much of the time with the Java, because, like, you know, for some of my clients, I have to like use the Java and I have to analyze the stuff. So I build like my Java. You can see actually, like, I open the code. It's a Java class and a jar file reader. So which reads the information, and you can use it, like, you know, for your stuff. I'm still like want to optimize it, and maybe to build like some kind of simple emulator, like in a Java emulator, when you can play and do some kind of analysis with that. So, but that is on my GitHub account, and you can look at the code. It's built completely on the Crystal, but initially I built that code on the JavaScript, then I ported to this Swift, and then I ported it to the Crusoe.
Okay, okay. And for those that have not used a language that has a really good built-in debugger, because Ruby does not have a great debugging ecosystem, it is hard to fully understand the benefits of a debugger. I think we need like an article or something of like why debuggers are awesome and why, like, because when people come in from Ruby, I don't think there's like a debugging like culture. But if you've ever been in a language where debuggers are like C++, if you know someone who can rock a C++ debugger or a C# debugger, holy cow, you can get a lot of info out of there, and you can like so much like makes sense. And I mean, it's just interesting. I think that like in some cases we just need a little bit of an update on why certain things, why debuggers make so much sense, because
I can tell
you.
So like think of it, so like the Ruby debugger, or like, you know, like the way you test it, it's like if you if you're just riding on the buggy or small toy cars, right? And when you start to reuse like, you know, really good debugger like C# debugger and whatever, it's like if you're sitting in the luxurious limousine and driving like, you know, like really high speed, really comfortably, you can do anything like, you know, just from you can just touch and it will work. It will show you all the information. So it's like you are a kind of semi-god which have all the information about your application.
Yeah. And like, yeah, so you get all the information about the application. There is a really cool thing too where you can like, when you're in a debugger, you can like in Ruby and you drop into a pry, you start typing variable names, you start doing different things, and you in other debuggers, like all that stuff is there and you're just watching it change in real time, and you can, you know, manually manipulate things. It's just, it's a different window into the program, and you get a lot of granularity and control all at once. I think that like, I don't know, I just wish that someone who knew a lot more about debuggers could do like a really great tutorial.
Why, like, Pry is good, but like, you know, the Ruby right now have a really good debugger support. So finally, like, with that IDE debugger, whatever it is, plugin, which is part of the Ruby mine. And so, like, you, or even individual studio code, you can do, you know, they have really good debugger support for now. So you don't have to use Pry for that.
I didn't know that. I want to go check that out now.
Yeah, but so like your individual studio is a little bit finicky, but yeah, it gives you all the information about the variables. You can see anything, like, and you can go through. Or you can you can download RubyMine, which is doing that for a very long time, at least like for 10 years. Definitely they have really good debugger support.
Oh, I didn't know that. RubyMine, you have to pay for, and I
they
I
have
really
some
like
kind
RubyMine.
Of, yeah, no, they have trial. Actually, I have my license.
Okay.
I paid for the license for Ultimate version, so where I have everything.
That's interesting. The one thing about RubyMine too that I really like is you could right click on a class and click show me the file that this comes from, and it was not going to grep. They had some algorithm for lookup to file name to something. They had some really good features in RubyMine.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that keeps me away from that program specifically, because I have used it in the past and I have purchased it in different workplaces that I've worked at, so just like different businesses, but the fact that you have to use a subscription really turns me off from it, and I don't know if I'd buy it now. But
what you can do, what I've done, so like I bought my personal subscription, so I paid for that, and I bought like in that Ultimate one when I can use everything, it's my toolbox. So you're paying about like $200 US a year, I believe.
Yeah. Okay.
And or maybe $240, and I'm not one right now. And then you can, like, you know, next year you're paying like $150 only.
Oh, okay.
So, like, I paid for 2 years and now I stopped it. So I stopped it, like, I canceled my subscription and I still keep my old code. Like, you know, now I have my code. Maybe it's not that new. Maybe it's like, you know, half a year old, and that's what I will keep for forever. For all the products, for IntelliJ, like Ultimate. For like, you know, I will use it probably like 2019 instead of 2020.
Nice.
But it's still like, you know, it's still good code. Still good code. Like, you know, it's more than enough. I can recommend the same.
Yeah, they have a really good database tool as well. I forget what it's called.
DataMiner. Data Grip is good.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah, I would like it. If I could buy a license, I'd probably own one. I might do what you did. see if I can.
It's not expensive for the toolbox. It's a must because you will get everything. You get the Sea Lion. By the way, like when I was debugging, like, you know, remember, like initially I saw that the issue with the debugger itself, GDB. Remember, like I said, like, you know, I was able to fix it, and so to find that fix, like I was using the Sea Lion to debug debugger.
Interesting. Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
I was a little DB itself. And I used Sea Lion for that. And it was really, really, really convenient.
I heard a lot of people really like Sea Lion. I think it's really cool that you've worked on the debugger. I just wish that we could get it some more. I think the response has been really good. You had a ton of stuff on your original forum post. You had, you know, the PR one had a lot of comments and a lot of interest. And your follow-up post got a lot of traction compared to all the posts on the forum. So, like, I think people like it. I just wish that I could show people, like, why debuggers are cool. And I kind of wish that I'd understand more about them.
I will try to make the screenshot. My next step will be to make the screenshots, and now I have to figure out the time to make the screenshots, and then I will just post it. Maybe so, like, I will create my blog on my website. So the funny stuff, I have my domain name, but then I have my website because I don't know what I should tell about myself. I provide the services to companies, right? Like for the architecture and whatever, but I don't know what should I tell about myself because. I know too much.
Can do Fortran. Will Fortran for Will Fortran for
work. I have lots of experience in reverse engineering.
Oh, you're like, in security. Yeah. So I want to cover some more things.
I do security for this one. Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I work for some kind of more fintech companies who I provide security stuff. Yeah.
Okay. I want to cover. I want to cover a little bit more things about the debugger before we move on to security, but I'm definitely taking a quick note about that. The biggest thing is that I'm really curious, when designing a language, almost everyone I know that's built a debugger has built a Lisp debugger because that's the college thing to do. But what makes a language better or worse to integrate with a debugger? Like, are there design decisions that affect the ability to be able to use a debugger?
Yes and no at the same time, because you see, like, as long as you can stop program at some moment, as long as you can access the information in the memory, as long as you can understand what that information, how to show it on the screen, you're good.
Okay. So there's not really like, you know, like, for example, Ruby seems to be a difficult language to build like a proper debugger for. Is that a language problem or is that a tooling problem?
I don't think that Ruby have the issue with the debugger because it's still, like, you know, the debugger I was talking about in the Ruby one, it shows that it's fine. And that means, like, you know, if you're able to stop the program, like, at that specific amount. But again, because it's still, like, you know, like, that depends how you implement your virtual machine for the language.
Okay. So there is, like, a little bit of a virtual machine design thing to make a debugger more or less, like, accessible to the user, right?
Yes. That's definitely. So if you implement that code, like in the compiler, and if it will be accepted, so then you will be able to see anything.
And how does Crystal compare? Like, was Crystal a language that its design was, like, amenable to having a debugger?
I'm sorry?
Was Crystal easy to implement a debugger for? And is there any, like, compiler feature or change that would make a debugger easier in the language?
No, because I see, like, here, the Crystal is piggybacking on top of the LLVM, and because of you have to use LLVM or infrastructure. And so this is the reason why it took, even for myself, a long time, because I see, like, you, and I have lots of experience, right? So it took me half a year to be able to make it right. And I spend, like, quite a lot of time on it. And the issue is to understand how properly to integrate it. You have to dive into the LLVM, LLDB, the debugging information, how they read it, how it understand, or, you know, how they process it properly, what needs to be done. And so if you understand all that stuff, if you have really good experience as a system programmer, for example, then yes, you will be able to build it. But you see, right now, it's not many of system programmers. Like, most of the people is trying to use the high-level languages, and they lose that grip on the low level, right? Because you see, for me, I hate to have black boxes. If I don't understand how stuff works, for me, it irritates me. So I dive into the code as deep as possible. And if I understand, for example, how it works on the CPU level, even on the even on the semiconductor level, or on the level how the MMU works, or for example how the pipelines in the CPU works. So when you have all the information,
you're talking some pretty deep levels. For people who don't know, MMU is memory management unit. I think you discovered that you're talking about registries, which are kind of like variables for CPU. I mean, you're at a level that I really love talking about, but it's not discussed that much. I'm really curious.
I knew about the Elon Musk maybe 10 years ago, and it was the first time I heard about him and about his first principles. But I was using the first principles before, way before that. So for me, the first principles is a must. If you want to understand stuff, dive in.
Yeah.
You must understand how it works on the very low level, on the level of the atoms, and up. So then you're just building the abstractions, which you're just reading and understand. So you don't have to remember everything. But if you work in this level of abstractions, but at the same time, you keep in mind the information around it, so how it's actually working on the low level, you will understand much better, and you'll understand about all the consequences.
100% agree. I'm really curious. So in the previous performance work that I was doing, even some performance work in Ruby, I was measuring L2 and LLC cache misses. So L1 cache misses, I couldn't optimize in Ruby. That's a whole other problem. But I wonder
L1 still can, because it depends on your cache, how much of the bytes you will put into the cache, how it's aligned. That's what the L1 and L2. It's all about
So for people who don't know, we're talking about the caches inside a CPU. So inside a modern CPU, one that's been made in the past 20 years, there is a level 1, level 2, and a level 3 or LLC cache, and then RAM. And the more things you can access from the closer or the lower numbered caches, the faster your CPU can execute something. And so it's a very good way to optimize a program, because it's an incredibly long round trip to RAM, which sounds funny, but it's true. So that's what we're talking about. And I'm really curious, I haven't really done any of this work inside Crystal yet, but I should really go back and apply some of those methodologies to see, how Crystal compares. I mean, some of that stuff, when I was doing some stuff with Ruby, it was about optimizing cache lines and using smaller objects. And the smaller objects, the less cache you evict and that kind of stuff. So I'm sure you could apply some of the same principles to Crystal. But it'd be interesting this comes down to using a good debugger and getting the right info.
Because LLVM is doing it for you.
Yeah, it's true. Well, LLVM can do some optimizations for you, but if you still have a really fat struct and you're pushing it through all the caches, you're just going to evict a lot of things you don't want to evict. Yeah. So, I mean, there's some interest. Like, some of this stuff is just like understanding low level stuff. Some of this stuff is having the right tools to be able to get CPU counters and other things out of there. And some of it is like debuggers. And I think that there's a lot of really interesting low level stuff that if people knew, they'd be able to make their programs faster, understand what's going on.
Yeah. For example, when I was working on the firewall, I was talking about, and I want to talk about a little bit, back then. So I was able to optimize the code in the way so I can find any rule, from 1 million of the rules, I can find that in 100 CPU cycles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. And so for people who don't know, cycle is a generic count for how much work or for what a CPU can do. For example, you can do an instruction, but you can also do 10 or 5 instructions inside one CPU cycle. So
because they're parallelized. Yeah.
That's
how I was able to achieve on Pentium 3, 500 megahertz, I was able to achieve 420,000 packets per second.
Yep.
With 1 million rules and connections.
That's bananas. That's super cool.
And back then, the checkpoint firewall, it was back in 2001. Checkpoint firewall with one rule and one connection and with two CPUs, the 3 gigahertz was able to make only 160 packets per second.
Yep. That's crazy. I mean, that's some fun times. I didn't even know. That's a lot.
Yeah, I know.
And you're talking about packets. So that's a lot of, you're pushing a lot of data through a CPU. You know, that's interesting.
Yeah,
and
that's
then firewall,
you're using the DMA. It's even more low level core
yeah.
stuff, like, you know, how to use the DMA to move the data without, like, you know, using the CPU and all this stuff. It's crazy. I still love it.
Yeah, it's super fun. It's a world that I don't interact with as much, and it's a super interesting world. I'm not really aware, like, where the big system programming jobs are out there. Like, I mean, so much stuff has been pushed into web applications that I feel like whenever I look around, that's a lot of the jobs that are out there. But you know, system level programming is, for those who are interested, it is super fun, and the history is fascinating because people have been doing crazy stuff at low levels. So, like, you talk about, you know, now, you know, kind of the progressions that are made, and even just talking about what AMD is doing in the past few years and why they become so popular with their chiplet with their chiplet design. I mean, the chiplet design is changing the PC landscape.
But man, it's really fun. So we can talk about this forever, but that's the time we have to probably wrap up.
yeah, it is time to wrap up. Thank you for keeping me on track. We'll have to make another call and talk about security sometime, because I'm super fascinated with security in general. Yeah. Well, why don't we end with, what are you working on these days? And if people want to find you, where can they find you?
I have my company, IT Audit, where I'm real, it's my consulting company. So I provide, like, second IT second opinion because of my extreme, extensive, like, knowledge at, like, cloud computing, like, at, like, still, at security, at solution architecture, to cloud architecture, solution architecture, cloud security architecture, like, software architecture, like, DevOps, DevSecOps, like, automation QA, So I consider myself as IT generalist who knows not just, like, a little bit about that, but quite a lot about all that stuff because of my 37 years of experience, right?
Because
of that, I trying to apply a holistic approach on the problem. That's why all my systems working for so long, and I'm still, like, trying to help people to improve the stuff. So, for example, like, I provide services like CTO as a service, when I just, or, like, you know, as a CTO advisor, so when I can look at their issue and provide them second opinion about, so what they have good, what they have wrong. They can also, like, ask some other opinion, and then just to compare, and based on that information, it helps them to understand their problem and how to solve it better. If
awesome.
They need it, I can help them as well. So, like, I have my team in Belarus who may help me to build some code, because as of myself, I'm building only all the proof of the concepts, and when this real programming goes, then I just pass it to them.
Okay. And for those who didn't hear, what is that URL one more time?
Oh, like, my company, it's like iteverdeed.com, but it's nothing there. So if you contact me, you always can, you know, feel free to contact me over my, my LinkedIn, like, send me LinkedIn request to contact with me. You always can find me by Sergey Kuznetsov, iteverdeed.inc, or you can send me the email, or you can find me, like, you always can find me on the Crystal channel.
Okay.
Like, I'm on the Crystal Slack, so, like, I'm always there. You always can send me the message there.
I think that they got, we have some instructions now for your LinkedIn, but what is your email, just in case people want to reach out?
So my email, you can send it to Sergey, Sergey, at iteverdeed.
Awesome.
.com. And iteverdeed means, like, you know, the erudite, it's the guy who knows everything, who knows everything. And in this case, it's just about IT.
Okay. And for those who are looking for us, this is Chicago Crystal. You can find us on Twitter, and we have chicagocrystal.org for our website. If you want to look at our LinkedIn and on YouTube, we are also Chicago Crystal. We do not have the name yet, so if we get 100 subscribers, we will actually claim the name Chicago Crystal. And I am Jack Thorne, and I am 123 on the internet, WONTRUEFREE. And thank you for listening to Chicago Crystal, and we will see you all soon. A big thank you to our producer, Christy Flores, who edits these podcasts, and our DJ, Bill Wesley, who provides the tracks and samples for these episodes. This was an episode of Chicago Crystal, building community and getting stuff made in our favorite language. We'll see you soon.